House Committee on Consumer Protection to order. Got a pretty full agenda, so I'm going to try to keep moving along. Got a couple of public, a couple of work sessions to go through. And I'm going to start off with House Bill 2871 first. So I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 2871. And I'd like, committee, we've had the Dash 8 amendments distributed. And I'd like to have Legislative Council come up and walk us through this. I believe we had him up before talking about the Dash 6, if my memory serves me correctly. And maybe he can point out how this, what changes are in this. Yeah, and... And I don't know, I'm not asking the Department of Consumer and Business Services to come up, but if the committee has specific questions that they may answer, they are here in the room, so... Thank you.
Chair Hovey, members of the committee, for the record, Sean Brennan from Legislative Council. The Dash 8 you have before you are relatively not that different from the Dash 6s, and the particulars that we're looking at for the differences between the Dash 8s and the Dash 6s, and for this discussion I'll assume that we have already gone over the Dash 6s in a fair amount of detail. The difference in the Dash 8 has to do with the definition of consumer loan. Consumer finance loan is now the definition, defined term, and that was to alleviate some concerns by some of the consumer finance lending industry that we were in Chapter 725 lumping them in with payday lenders and title lenders or other short-term lenders. We want to make the distinction clear by redefining that term. And now the term no longer includes definition for payday lenders and title lenders. It really is aimed only at consumer finance lenders and also includes loans of longer than 60 days. Under Section 2 of the amendments on page 2, we are now also, because of that redefinition of the term on page 1, adding a subsection 2 that talks about which particular loans the licensing requirement under Section 2 will apply to. That does include payday loans, as they are defined in 725-600, title loans, the same, or consumer finance loans, as previously defined on the page we just looked at. And then we also have exemptions under subsection 3. Those exemptions now also include a phrase for those folks who are not actually collecting any kind of fee or consideration in connection with a loan or a loan application made, and that they do not interact directly with the borrower or consumer, act as an intermediary between a borrower and a lender or a broker, or transmit information electronically or otherwise. This is meant to try and get out from the licensing requirement those folks who really have nothing to do with the loan itself but are really just handling loan documents or serving as intermediaries between the borrowers and the lenders. People like people who print checks for distribution to the eventual consumer, or that collect mailmen, couriers, people like that who collect loan applications. We don't want to include those folks in the licensing requirements, so they are exempted under subsection 3. Looking on page 3 of the amendments in lines 8 through about 23, or actually a little bit below that, actually lines 8 through the rest of the page, we now have a different requirement for fees and other consideration that lenders can charge in connection with loans granted under this chapter. Looking at lines 14 through 30, we have here, in addition to the amount that they can contract for under the sub A that you see listed there from line 7 to 13 on page 3, that's a 36% APR cap that was in the Dash 6 as previously. We're now adding to that the sub B, which allows lenders to charge, in addition to that 36% cap, certain fees. Those fees will be subject to oversight and regulation by DCBS, and they are listed as examples that are included in here are prepayment fees, fees and damages that are in accordance with the Non-sufficient fund check statute, ORS 30.701. Actual expenses the licensee incurs in collecting a debt and that has been a default or a failed to repay. Amounts that are associated with the collection of defaulted loan. And other items that are excluded under the Truth in Lending Act from the APR calculation, and those are listed actually in the cited statute 15 U.S.C. 1605 D and E. Those include items such as, let's see, fees and charges prescribed by law, which are paid to public officials for any reason, premiums payable for insurance, taxes levied, and items exempted from the computation of the finance charge and extensions of credit secured by interests in real property. That things, those are things like fees or premiums for title examinations, title insurance for loans that are secured by real property, preparation of loan-related documents, escrows, fees for notarizing deeds and other documents, credit reports and appraisal fees, things of that nature. Those are excluded from the APR calculation in sub A, but they are allowed to be charged under sub B as other fees that the lender can charge. And some page 4, section 7, we're simply adding to the, that's in lines 10 through 14, we're adding broker to the list of folks who are already required to be licensed under the title and payday lending statutes. That's again aimed at the folks who will be forming subsidiaries or otherwise trying to evade the licensing requirement by coming up with a third party who is not a lender, strictly speaking, but who does perform duties in connection with actually making the loan. And I think the remainder of the amendment is pretty much as was the case in dash sixes. I'd be happy to entertain any questions from the committee.
Sean, thanks for all your work on this. I know we've been going back and forth a lot. And on page 3 of the dash 8 amendment, line 24, where we're talking about the fees that can be charged that are outside the Truth in Lending Act, on line 24 we mentioned prepayment fees. And I was curious in anywhere in here, because it was I believe our intent to make sure that late fees were included, and I don't see them listed specifically. Are they included in this, or do we need to add them in somehow?
Representative Holvey, I believe we do need to add them in. I looked at the items included under sub large A, lines 20 through 23, that does not include late fees. None of the other listings B through E actually specifically include late fees, so that was an oversight on my part, for which I apologize.
Okay, so if in fact when we do adopt these, I would probably consider a conceptual amendment if the committee's okay to add and late fees for the interest of the industry specifically. But are there any questions from the committee of legislative counsel on his walk through this amendment or of the overall bill in general?
Are we in work session?
Yes, we are.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the dash 4 amendments.
Representative Gilliam has moved the dash 4.
No,
Representative Girard. It's usually Gilliam. Representative Girard has moved the dash 4 amendment to House Bill 2871. Do I have any discussion from the committee on that? Other than I intend on moving the dash 8 amendments, as you probably know already. I respect your motion.
Yes, for discussion, Mr. Yeah. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm concerned about the dash 4 amendments because they don't contain the 36% cap, which is the goal of the bill, so I'll be voting against the dash 4 amendments.
Thank you. Mike, can we start off with Representative Riley and move this direction on our vote count again this week?
Representative Riley?
No.
Representative Gilliam?
Yes.
Representative Nelson?
No.
Representative Mongeese?
No.
Representative Galizia?
No.
Representative Durad?
Yes.
Chair Mulvey?
No. The motion, not having received required I votes, has failed.
I'm surprised.
Mr. Chair, I would like to make a motion on the Dash 8 amendment in light of the fact that Mr. Brennan talked about how the exclusion of the late fees was a sort of administrative error. I'd like to propose that we handle that with a conceptual amendment. So I move the Dash 8 amendment to House Bill 2871 with the conceptual amendment adding and late fees to page 3, line 21.
Clarification, I believe it's line 24.
Sorry.
Start on page 3?
Yeah.
Line 24. Okay. Do I need to start over?
No. I think I can restate that. Representative Bonamici moves the adoption of the Dash 8 amendments to House Bill 2871 with the conceptual amendment adding and late fees on page 3, line 24, after the words prepayment fees. Any discussion? Any objection? Well, since we start out with a roll, Mike, why don't you go ahead and give us a roll call, please?
Representative Riley?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Nelson?
Aye.
Representative
Bonamici?
Aye.
Representative Galizia?
Aye.
Representative Durad?
Aye.
Chair Mulvey? Aye. The Dash 8 amendments having received the required votes is adopted to House Bill 2871 with the conceptual amendment of add late fees, page 3, line 24, after prepayment fees.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 2871 as amended with the Dash 8 amendments, including the conceptual amendment, to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bonamici moves House Bill 2871 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Holvey, Chair Holvey. I just want to make a comment that we've been through several series of amendments in order to address some of the concerns that were raised in our previous discussions, allowing for more flexibility with fees, with the APR calculation, and for the post-transaction fees by adding those into the Dash 8 amendment. So I'm happy to be supporting this bill.
Thank you. Representative Galizio.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I first wanted to thank Representative Nelson for the cookie with the pink ribbon on it that we were all given, and I know it's worth $9, so we're okay. I appreciate that. And, you know, Mr. Chair, this bill has been an educational experience. I made the mistake in 1999 of working with a professor from OSU to write a textbook. And you sort of iteration after iteration and change, and this has been a similarly painful process. And I noticed my name is on the bill, so I still have some concerns about the unanticipated consequences of the bill, but I think we should get this out of this committee so we don't have to see it any longer.
Well, thank you, Representative Galizia. I'm sure many others share your sentiment. But I do want to acknowledge some of the consumer finance industry that did try to give us their best advice, and DCBS for the technical assistance, and legislative counsel, specifically Sean Brennan, for all his hard work on this and in trying to make this a better bill for consumers as well as the consumer finance industry as well. So I appreciate that. Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is especially important to me today. Because yesterday in Yamhill County, we lost a person who had committed her life to those with really tough, tough situations in their lives. And it was Sherry Schmidt, or Sherry Gar Schmidt, who has ran a food bank for about 18 hours a day for year after year. And unfortunately, the friends with whom she was staying went in to wake her up, she was gone from us. And I just think how proud she'd be today to know, you know, she's gone, but we're going to continue to support individuals who have tough times, tough luck. And hopefully with our help, these people get going.
Thank you. Mr. Riley, would you please call the roll?
Representative
Riley? Aye. Representative Gillian? No. Representative Nelson?
Aye.
Representative
Bonici? Aye. Representative Gerard? No. Chair Holby?
Aye.
House Bill
2871, having received the required votes, is passed on to the floor. Mr. Chair, I will probably be filing a minority report. So noted. Representative Gerard has noted a minority report. I'm going to assign this bill to Speaker Merkley. He deserves it. With that, I'd like to close the work session on House Bill 2871. You did that in a nice way.
Mr. Speaker.
With that, I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 3103. And I'd like to request DCBS to come up and give us whip. Oh, that would be Joel.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Joel Ario, Administrator of the Insurance Division within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. House Bill 3103 is a bill that came out of a recommendation from our health report, which we've discussed here previously. It's a fairly simple and straightforward bill. It says that when rate filings are made on health filings, which are prior approval type filings, that those filings be immediately available on our website to the public. And we think that will be more transparent, create more accountability for us, and also enhance competition in the marketplace. And so we would recommend adoption, or we support the bill and recommended adoption of the bill. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Does the committee have any questions on House Bill 3103 for Mr. Ario?
Is there amendments on that?
No. Looks like you're off the hook here. Thank you for being present.
This is going to be good news.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3103 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bonamici moves House Bill 3103 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? No discussion. I got a note from somebody that might like to speak to this. Please come forward.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Elise Brown representing America's Health Insurance Plans, and surprised to see that it was just listed as a work session today. We did have other members who, I believe, submitted written testimony. Hopefully you received that.
Did you pass out the written testimony? I do have some written testimony, yes.
So I just wanted to make sure you received that.
I have testimony from Pacific Source Health Plans. Would you like me to read that into the record?
I would, please.
Okay, Pacific Source Health Plan supports efforts to increase public awareness of health care costs and issues. The current process of making public all rates approved by the Oregon Insurance Division provides transparency to consumers in terms of insurance rates, which we believe serves Oregonians well. Filed rates include all rates filed by each carrier with the OID. These rate filings are often amended or adjusted before a rate filing is finalized and approved by the OID. Approved rates are the final rates filed by each carrier and approved by the OID for use. Carriers will only use the approved rates, which is a more limited set of documents than filed rates documents. Approved rates are currently available to the public. House Bill 3103 will make all rates filed with the OID immediately available to the public. While we support House Bill 3103 conceptually, we do not believe it is necessary. We are not aware of any current restriction that impedes the public's access to approved rates. Conclusion, Pacific Source Health Plan supports the concept of making rates available to the public. However, we do not believe that making rates filed or making filed rates available to the public will provide any tangible benefit and may merely serve to increase the OID's administrative burden. We believe that only approved rates should be made available to the public.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I just wanted to make sure that we had an opportunity to respond, and there may be others who traveled here specifically to say something to that effect today.
Thank you. I was under the impression that we just had testimony in 2002 from town. I wasn't aware that we had people on this bill.
Mr. Chair, it was my understanding that you were going to hear both those bills today, so I apologize.
Okay.
Yes. I just want to point out that that's very similar to the testimony that was submitted in the during the public hearing on this bill earlier.
Right.
Same
issues. So we have heard that testimony before, and certainly if you have do we have a sign up? We don't have a sign up sheet for this because it's not public hearing; it's only a work session. So. I guess I will allow some other folks to come up, but at this time I'd like to call Representative Nathanson up, if you don't mind.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Speak in a few minutes.
Greetings, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nathanson.
I was not prepared to speak to this topic today because I was under the understanding that it's the committee's work session and not a public hearing. But I did want to observe and hear the discussion, and I would just like to summarize for about 60 seconds the impetus for bringing forth this bill and the concept. DCBS had a report on what they thought would be important and effective in improving health insurance and the oversight of health insurance and rate setting and so forth. And there were several concepts, half a dozen or more concepts. Some of those are in front of this committee as other bills, separate bills. My bill I put forward separately because actually the information about it and the recommendation came out just sort of sequentially after some of those other proposals had been developed. So I picked this one up as being an integral and important piece of that package of recommendations that the department put forward. They did have input. They considered whether it was possible to do it, effective to do it, legal. Everything seems to me to indicate that this would help. No one of these proposals is going to fix a problem by itself. No one of these proposals is going to be the panacea or the thing that makes improve public confidence or the big fix for the cost of health care or how to redo the insurance industry. All this is merely providing information that the public would presumably have access to anyway, but it's very difficult to have access to it. It's providing that information so the public or people representing the public teams of advocates, for example, just making it possible for them to see what's already happening. That's simply all it is.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions of Representative Nathanson? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For coming forward. And I'll call Elise Brown back up to the dais. And, you know, the Pacific sort. Representative Riley.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. I'm interested in hearing any new information or new ideas. I would ask you to ask the testifiers to limit themselves to things that we haven't already heard.
Thank you, and I apologize for that. The testimony that I reread was entered into our first public hearing that you asked me to read into the record again, and so I'm sort of redundant for the committee, I assume. So if you have somebody else that wishes to offer us a new perspective, I'm inviting that testimony in this work session right now.
Okay, and I apologize. I have to look around. I'm not sure that there's any new additional folks. We talked about it yesterday, and I believe that there were some that were going to maybe come forward today. So all I wanted to do is hold the hand up and make sure that we had an opportunity to respond. And I appreciate you allowing me to do that.
Okay, so we have received your testimony in private prior public hearing, and we read it into the record again in the work session, and your information is so noted. So
I appreciate you that.
Thank you
for
very
doing
much.
That. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
I still have a motion on the table, and we're under discussion. The motion was to adopt House Bill 3103, if I recall, by
right.
Representative Bonamici, with a due pass recommendation. Mr. Riley, would you call the roll?
Representative Riley?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
Excused.
Representative Nelson?
Aye.
Representative Bonamici?
Aye.
Representative Galizio?
Aye.
Representative Girard?
Nay.
Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 3103, having received the required votes, is declared passed. And Representative Nathanson, would you like to carry this bill on the floor? Thank you. Representative Nathanson will carry House Bill 3103 to the floor. With that, I'd like to close the work session on House Bill 3103 and open up a work session on House Bill 2002. And at this time, I'd like to invite up Joel Aereo. I'm sure you were planning on this. Ed Niebert and Laura Etherton, if you could all come forward.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, again, Joel Aereo, Administrator of the Insurance Division within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I tried the same kind of short testimony I did on 3103, but somehow I don't think that'll quite work on this bill. So I have a few more things to say, but I'll try to be as brief as possible. I don't want to detain all the high-priced lobbyists in the room for the telecommunications bill. Let me start with a couple comments that are an overview of the issue. You have in front of you today a set of talking points for me, and that's what I'll cover here. You also have a one-page summary of our proposed amendments to the bill, and you have the full amendments, which are run some 16 pages because they amend a lot of different sections of the law. The two overview issues I'd want to bring to your attention are, first, you will hear in a minute from Mr. Niebert, who will present in more detail some really good work that the American Health Insurance Plans has done to show what would happen under various scenarios of change in the small group market. The dominant point I think I'd highlight for you in that data is that whatever scenario the committee adopts, there will be some people who will pay more for insurance, and there will be some people who will pay less. There are no situations when you get into these difficult rating issues in which everybody wins. Everybody gets to pay lower rates. There also are no scenarios in which everybody loses. So we're always talking about balancing interests here, And Ed will get into some of the detail of that from their perspective. When looking at that data, as I've talked to various people, I've talked to the insurance industry, I've talked to consumer groups, I see quite different takes on the data, and I think this is an important kind of orientation principle here. Ultimately, how you view the data in terms of who the winners are, who the losers are, depends a lot on what you think equity means in the health insurance marketplace. There are some people who think equity means that everyone should pay the same rate. We ought to have a health system in which everybody pays the same and people are not discriminated against based on whether they have good health status, bad health status, young, old, what industry they work for, and so forth. That often goes under the rubric of community rating. We ought to have a community rated system. That is how most large employers do health insurance. They have one composite rate and everybody in the shop partakes in that composite rate. It's not how we do individual insurance. So there are differences in different parts of the market. The other view of equity is that everyone should pay their own costs. So if you're less healthy, you ought to pay more than if you're more healthy. If you work in an industry that's more prone to health problems, you ought to pay more and so forth. Those are the two basic views. They're diametrically opposed to each other. And as I hear people talk, I think a lot of it comes out of which of those forms of equity you think is more important. Not surprisingly, I talked to the consumer groups represented by Laura here today. They think equity means the first type. Everyone should pay as close to community rated rates as possible, and the insurers tend to think on the other side of the issue that people ought to pay closer to their own cost. They're more concerned about preserving the best risks in the marketplace, and that is important, driving down rates for everybody. And so that's kind of an important point to start with. In terms of then how we come out on the bill, we are proposing basically 5 points in our amendment. Some of these are consistent with the original bill. First, to expand the small group market from 2 to 25 to 2 to 50 employees. That is in the original bill. We believe that is an important principle today to stabilize the small group pool, have more lives in the pool, and generally make it a more predictable pool for everybody. Secondly, we would maintain the current 2.5 to 1 rate band. And I'll explain a little bit more about rate bands in a couple minutes, but that currently under law, the 2 to 25 market, which is the regulated market, does have that 2.5 to 1 rate band. If the legislature were to take no action in this session, that would go back to 2 to 1, so it would be a tighter rate band, closer to community rating. But we recommend that the legislature do take action and preserve the current 2.5 to one. And this is one of the key issues. We looked at the HIPAA data, and we look at it more from the equity as everyone should pay as close to the same rate as possible. And we see that at that 2.5 to 1 rate band, 54% of the groups will either have the same rates or better rates. So the majority, the clear majority, benefits from that 2.5 to 1 rate band. There are a significant number of people who will pay more. 46% would pay more. And in the CHI market, keeping it at 2.5 to 1, the market that's currently regulated 2 to 25, that obviously there aren't going to be any winners and losers if we leave it the same. So that's what informed our decision to recommend a 2.5 to 1 rate band. We third propose that we allow more flexible rating within the rate band. You'll hear a lot today about how the one factor that's currently allowed in the rate band, which is age, is an imperfect predictor of costs and risks, and so it may make sense to add some factors, and we will discuss some of the ones that we propose to add to the current factors of just age right now. Fourth thing is that we believe the bill will streamline other regulatory requirements in the bill. The most important streamlining measure here is simply combining these two markets eliminates a lot of regulatory concerns over, you know, who's in 2 to 25, who's in 26 to 50. There are different rules in the two markets. That causes a lot of complexity. So making one market by itself is a streamlining measure, and then we also propose some streamlining in how carriers can count eligible individuals and so forth to make that process easier. And then finally, because no matter what the committee does, there will be some people who will gain and some people who will lose, we propose that the changes be phased in. We propose over a 3-year period. So that's the summary. The two issues that are probably the most difficult here are how the rate bands themselves work and then what exactly should be the new rating factor. So I'll talk a little bit more about each of those issues. We're trying to understand how rate bands work. You start under our laws with each carrier has a geographic average rate for the seven different regions of the state. The state is carved into seven regions, and they start with a number that's their base rate in each of those geographic areas. To illustrate how what the rate bands mean in terms of real numbers, and this, if you look at my sheet, you can follow along here. If you take $100, obviously a low number, but just for illustration purposes, the geographic average rate in an area was $100. If you have a 2-to-1 rate band, which is what we'd fall back to, then that means that the lowest price group in that market would have a $67 rate, and the highest group would have a $133 rate, twice a 2-to-1 rate band. If you take the 2.5-to-1, which is what we have currently and what we recommend, it would mean the lowest rate is down $10 from $67 to $57, and the highest rate is up $10, so up to $143. So that's the broader range. And then finally, a 3-to-1 rate band, which I believe is what the carriers will recommend today, would be $50 on the low end and $150 on the high end. So you can keep those numbers in mind as to what kind of differences we're talking about when we talk about the different rate bands. Again, as I said, current law allows inside the rate band age-only rating. We recommend to add several factors because three reasons. One, it does reduce the impact of age. If age is the only factor, then if you're a group of 60-year-olds, you're pretty much going to be in trouble on your rates because it's just going to be about your age, and that's going to put you at the top end. And conversely, if you're a group of 20-year-olds, it's going to keep you on the bottom end. If you add some more factors, they may make your problem worse, they may make it better, but they kind of counterbalance usually in some form or fashion. So adding rating factors, we think, is a good idea, particularly the ones we're proposing create new incentives for wellness, new incentives for care, employers to expand coverage. And then we also allow some increased risk segmentation in the marketplace. So we try to have a kind of balanced view here. What are the rating factors that we propose? First of all, we propose that under current law, the age rating is based on the age of each employee. We propose it ought to be based on the age of all of the enrollees in the plan, which would include the dependents that are part of the plan. That gives you a broader, it's a more realistic look at the group, and we also like it because it encourages dependent coverage, because in general, leaving spouses aside, kids are going to be younger, and so groups that have more dependents in are going to do better on an age-rated system, and we think that's good to encourage dependent coverage. Secondly, we propose to allow rates to vary based on how much the employer contributes to the employees and dependent coverages. Employees can contribute anywhere from 0 to 100%, obviously. And we also support allowing rates to vary on what percent of employees participate in a plan. That's a very important variable for insurers. If you've got a plan that everybody's in a group of 25, that looks a lot better to an insurer than a group of 25 in which there are only 5 people in the plan. Because guess which 5 are most likely to be in the plan. So we think that's a good incentive and ought to be allowable as a rating factor as well. Again, all those things encourage more participation. They encourage the employer to get as many people involved in the plan as possible, and they encourage the employer to contribute more to the plan because it would help on the rates. Third, we support allowing rates to vary based on tobacco use and participation in wellness plans, as long as those wellness plans, and this is well defined carefully in the bill, focus on behaviors and not outcomes. So the kind of thing we're thinking is a wellness plan that says people take a health questionnaire, learn more about their health, and then take steps to achieve health, people attend classes, those sorts of things. It gets much more difficult, and in fact you run into barriers under federal law if you try to have a wellness program that's predicated on the outcomes, how healthy people end up. But encouraging people to go take certain behaviors that should improve health is, we think, a good thing to do, and we would have that be allowed as within the rate band as well. Finally, we propose to allow rates to vary based on longevity, how long you stay with the plan. That's common in other lines of insurance. People get discounts from their auto insurer if they stay with the same insurer over time. We think that ought to apply in the healthcare marketplace. It has the added feature here of giving the carrier, to the extent that they can achieve longevity, more incentive to work on long-term wellness issues. One of the things you hear, and one of the things we commented on in our report, is if a carrier thinks they're going to lose the group at the end of the current year, there's not a lot of incentive to invest in things that may not have payoff till the next year, maybe several years later. So we're not going to fully align incentives through this mechanism, but it does take a step in the right direction. So those are the quick summary of our amendments. With that, I'll stop so that we can get to, maybe you want to hear from everybody, or I'll take questions now if you want to.
Laura, why don't you go ahead?
Okay. Chair Holvey and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to talk about House Bill 2002 today. My name is Laura Etherton. I'm the consumer advocate with Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, or OSPIRG. I think overall, as Joel mentioned, actually, our approach to health insurance and health care is somewhat different from the consumer protection side. Really, what we're see as our goal, and I think a lot of consumers and members of the public and folks in the legislature see as well, is how do we actually make healthcare more affordable for people, for businesses, and make sure that people are getting good quality healthcare and are having good health outcomes. And insurance is a way to do that. It's a way to pool risk and pool costs and get people better health outcomes, ideally. In terms of the specifics on this, I think that we in order to gain the best advantages of pooling risk and pooling costs, the more that there is community rating, the better insurance works. That said, I think that, of course, there's always the challenge of balancing that with personal responsibility and making sure there are incentives for people to take care of themselves to the extent that that influences their health and how much they might experience in health insurance claims. In terms of the current rate band and allowing more flexible rating within the rate band, we're a little wary, I would say, to just make sure that extra flexibility within the rate band doesn't mean a lot of higher costs for folks, but that really does make the factors that go into considering what the rate should be are more that are more even. It makes sense not just to base that on age, but also to base it on factors that people have a little bit more control over. One caution, and I'm glad to see that it's not in here, is basing that at all on claims rating. That is an area that I think is too broad a brush and may actually backfire and have the effect of charging people more if they actually use their health insurance to get the prevention and the checkups that we want people to get in order to have better health outcomes. So I think that's important. Expanding the small group market to 50 makes sense for the efficiencies that Joel mentioned, and making sure that this trade-off is in the consumer's interest is something that we're concerned about, want to make sure that this actually does ultimately, ideally, result in lower rates and fairer rates for everyone, but that is really the goal overall. And so the more that the legislature can be looking at how to make healthcare more affordable for everyone, making sure insurance rates are fair and that they're affordable, that's the direction that we're enthusiastic about, and figure out who are the winners and who are the losers, and doing a lot of so trading back and forth between those pieces, I think, is a little bit of a distraction from the broader concern of how do we actually make healthcare better and more affordable for everybody. So we're generally supportive, and thank you very much.
Thank you. And Mr. Niebert.
Chair Holvey.
Just for everyone's information, we're not moving this bill today. So it's my intention to to hear from some more folks as time allows, but I think we have another bill left to hear, too, so we're going to try to keep that in mind.
Can I ask a question, though?
A point of information from Representative Girard?
I'd like to ask a question, actually, to Joel, if I could.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. You asked for amendments when you gave your initial testimony, and the conceptual amendment that I have here has insurer profits as one of the key factors to determine rates. And the question, obviously, what would be the rate of return that you would allow in that profit margin?
Mr. Chair, Representative Girard, the references to profitability and net investment income are in the original bill, so those aren't changes in the amendment. And the way they're listed, both in the original bill and in the amendment, which adds some other factors beyond those two, are all of these factors should be taken together. It's somewhat similar to what I was saying about why we think there ought to be more factors allowed when you're looking at rating in the small group market. The more factors you can look at in determining what to do, generally we find the better decisions we make. So we do take into account profitability and net investment income today, and the way we look at filings, the law isn't crystal clear on exactly what we would do with those, and we don't propose to make it specific as to this level of profitability causes this particular outcome. These things are all interrelated. Profitability is interrelated with losses this year, is interrelated with claims costs last year, and so forth. So what we're proposing in the original bill was those two factors to be added, and now in this amendment, the rest of the factors to be spelled out as well, so that the statutes are clear that all of these things ought to be taken into account.
Follow-up?
Yeah, quick follow-up. I mean, so the profitability question, that would be determined by rule?
Mr. Chair, Representative Girard, no. The way it works currently and the way it would work under this bill is these are factors to be considered without any mechanical rules about this level of profitability produces this result or this level of losses last year produces X result. I find it very difficult when I get into these issues with my actuaries because it's always like, okay, well, I understand this. Why doesn't this lead to this conclusion? And they almost always say, well, because there's another factor over here that cuts this way. And so that is how the process actually works, is to take the complex of factors into account. Same way the insurance companies put together their proposals, is to take a lot of factors into account and then come up with a conclusion. So all that we're saying is these ought to be factors to consider, not that they be given any specific weight or have any specific outcome attached to them.
Thank you. Mr. I believe it's Niebert. I hope I said that right.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, yes, you're correct. For the record, my name is Ed Niebert. I'm the Director of Regulatory Affairs for Providence Health Plan. I'm here today speaking on behalf of my industry colleagues in the health insurance industry to offer some what we think are refinements to some of the concepts that you've heard presented here already.
Mr. Niebert, is there somebody you'd like to have join you at the dais? I could perhaps ask Joel and Laura to step down if there's others that would like to come forward.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I don't think we need another party up here. I know we have two or three underwriting actuarial folks in the room if we get to questions of that detail, but I'll try to summarize our points here for you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I also want to commend the committee for not having fallen into a stupor listening to these technical details about rate bands and factors. I'll try not to send you into that state if you'll indulge me with about five more minutes. Those of you that have taken a look at the health insurance report that was published by DCBS back in January may recall that they made a proposal to expand what we call the small employer health insurance market from employers that have 2 to 25 employees up to an upper limit of 50 employees. And they cited three objectives for making that expansion: create a simpler regulatory environment, and that would be for the businesses themselves, for insurers, and for agents, instead of having a split market, a unified market. protect mid-size groups, that's the term I'll use for employers of 26 to 50 employees, against rate increases that are based on health experience, because today the small end of the market, 2 to 25, has rate regulations that are based on age differences, whereas the 26 to 50 segment of the market has a bigger mix of factors, and I'll talk about that in a moment. And strengthen the small group pool by expanding it, making the pool bigger, as Laura mentioned in her testimony, and that expansion would be about a 37% expansion from 193,000 enrollees up to about 264,000 enrollees. The health insurance industry supports those objectives, and we have some recommendations to make today that we think would meet those objectives in a way that smooths the transition for all of the affected groups, and that's a key issue. There will be transition issues. As Joel said, there will be winners and losers. We want to minimize, mitigate those transition impacts and enhance the long-term stability of this market. The primary impact that needs smoothing in this transition is the compression of rates for mid-size groups, that 26 to 50 group. Today, rates for mid-size groups are based on several factors that help predict their claim cost. Those factors include age, gender, industry type, and claims experience. With those factors, rates for most mid-size groups cluster together near the middle or average rate. But the total range, or bell curve, for groups with highest and lowest expected claims has a much broader spread. Joel described the current regulatory limit for small groups allows a rate spread of 2.5 to 1, or in my terminology, 250% from the lowest rate to the highest rate. That spread in the mid-size groups is broader. Maybe 4 to 1, or 4.5, or 5 to 1. So that compression, if we blend the rates, is a key transition factor. Also, the only factor currently allowed within the rate band for small groups today is age, and it's only employee age. It does not take into account dependent age. Joel spoke to that, and we support their recommendation that the age factor be expanded to include employees and dependents, because that would improve, that would encourage family participation. But there's another contrary factor that occurs with using age, and that is that it actually causes younger groups, who typically have lower average wages, to subsidize older groups that typically have higher wages. And we think that's another factor that ought to be mitigated by adding some other rate factors. So the challenge facing all of us is blending these two groups is to find the balance point where negative impacts are offset by positive impacts. And we have some balancing proposals to submit that we think help achieve that balance. First of all, as Joel said, and we're happy to hear this proposal, that there be a phase-in period of 3 years. We think that this would cushion the impact for this merging and would get us there in an orderly fashion. We would only point out that the phase-in would have to affect both ends of the rate range, cushioning both rate increases and rate decreases. Otherwise, if you just cushion the upper end of the new pool, you will actually put the pool out of balance by providing a subsidy at the upper end with no offset at the lower end. Secondly, we would propose a rate range or rate band of 3 to 1 instead of 2.5 to 1, as Joel talked about, and I want to emphasize that this range is not 3 to 1 above and below average, but it's 3 to 1 from lowest to highest. This modest expansion of the range would, we believe, reduce the transition impact for mid-sized groups whose current rates are at the edge of the bell curve, who are the sort of outliers in the current market, and it would encourage the enrollment of younger participants because it would better reward younger ages with a somewhat wider band. We would also propose the use of some additional risk factors to be used to more accurately determine where a group falls in the rate range. And here it's crucial to understand that there are primary and secondary rate protections that now apply to small groups, which would be extended to mid-sized groups. The primary protections are the average pooled rate that Joel talked about, the geographic average rate, the midpoint that everyone starts with, and then the rate range itself. Those are the primary protections. The average, what I call the average pooled rate, is the midpoint of the rate range. It's the starting point for every group before permissible rate factors are applied to determine where a group falls within the range. All groups, however, must remain in the range. So these rate factors never send anyone out of the range. They just position a group within the range. In addition to age, the mid-sized market today uses some other industry classifications. Those include some other factors. Those include industry classification, SIC code, and claims experience to more precisely reflect group risk. We would propose adding those factors to the new blended market. It's crucial to note that those factors would not generate rates that fall outside range limits, but they would allow more accurate calculation of rates within the range. Under our proposal, industry classification SIC would be a standard rate factor along with age. So everyone would start at the middle rate, the average rate, then you'd apply age and SIC to further refine their position within the range, and then we would propose a secondary factor of claims experience or risk modeling data to further refine their position. But we would propose that as secondary because it would have a limited or cushioning impact that would be defined by DCBS via rulemaking. The cushioning would ensure that dramatic rate swings, either up or down, do not result from this factor. And I want to close with just one, what I hope is important clarification. Joel talked about the two world views about equity. Is equity pay your own way, or is equity everybody pays the same? We don't view equity as good guys and bad guys. It's not a moral determination of, gee, folks who had more claims ought to pay more because they deserve it. We view that more accurately reflecting the actual risk of a group helps the stability of the pool. It allows those folks that have lower claims, younger ages, other factors, to be rewarded for that and keeps them in the pool. If you don't keep groups in the pool at the low end, the average rate keeps going up and people start falling out of the pool at both ends. So we view this not as a good guy, bad guy thing, but we view it as a rate stability factor, and that's why we would propose it. But again, we think the primary protection is the rate band itself, and we're just talking about using these factors to position a group within the rate band.
Thank you. And it was my intent to finish up with this panel at 2, but I'm going to allow, if anyone has a question that can be answered shortly, since we will be having more discussion on this bill. It's my intent to bring this bill back on Monday, actually, yet again, to allow us time to take in some of the data that we've been presented and to have conversations with the industry and with agency and advocates, and also if you can talk with each other and as we see these amendments coming forward, would be helpful to have some discussion amongst ourselves as well. Representative Nelson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Joel, did you give us this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, that looks like it came from our health report.
Yeah.
Thank you. Follow-up. I'm just curious, because I think this is an excellent document, but when you were talking about the consideration of factors, there are several in here, like the association-based programs.
things like that, cost control, containment, that you didn't mention in your factoring today. And so I wonder, when you come back on Monday, could you tell us why you didn't include those in the new considerations? Please, you don't have to talk about it today.
Brief comment, Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson. The issues that relate to rating, I think we have addressed here. Some of the other issues you're talking about have to do with issues outside of our control on the rating issues. But we will certainly take another careful look at the report and make sure that everything that's in there is, that relates to this proposal, is included in this proposal.
Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate the committee's indulgence to try to keep us on schedule and as I said, we will be reworking this bill again on Monday. Appreciate your testimony and bringing forth your data, your information. It is all going to be helpful in making us a little bit more informed about the decisions we make. Appreciate your testimony today.
Thank you.
With that, I'd like to close the public hearing slash work session on House Bill
2002,
work session, actually. And with that, I would like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2621. Mm-hmm. And first up on my list are the esteemed colleagues, Senator Frank Morris and Senator Vicki Walker.
Mr. Chair, are you going to give an overview?
Steve, would you give us an overview of the bill, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2621 allows telecommunications utilities to elect deregulation and also deals with some issues around alternative service providers who provide substantially similar service to landlines.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just need to make a brief statement before we start on this in the interest of full disclosure. My husband represents Quest. He's a lawyer in Portland, and he represents Quest not on this issue, but people in his law firm do represent Quest on this issue. So just in the interest of full disclosure, I just wanted to get that on the record. I do not talk to him about it. So I just wanted to make that clear.
Thank you for that. With that caveat, senators.
Hi, Mr. Chair. Nice to see you. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. I don't think I've ever been in front of your committee this session, so it's a pleasure to be in front of you. I'll go first. I told Senator Morse I'm always entertaining, so I'll take the first shot at it. This bill reminds me of a couple of sessions back. We had some pharmaceutical bills, and one of the newspapers editorialized and called the lobbyists suitcase lobbyists because there were so many of them in the building. I think that's what you could say about this bill. There are many lobbyists who have come to see me on this bill. There are many on this sheet of paper to oppose House Bill 2621, and I was looking over why they opposed the bill. Can't imagine why. And there were some things I wanted to respond to. First, let me say that I had a similar bill in the Senate, Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 539, but it's much shorter. We sort of do things a little more simpler in the Senate. Less words, more hot air, I guess. But House Bill 2621 actually goes a little bit further, and I won't make light of that, because, and the parties will discuss it with you. But I drafted Senate Bill 539 primarily because I believe that consumers need to have some place to go to with complaints with regard to wireless companies, voice over internet, cable, all of those things that are not currently regulated in terms of having a place to go. The folks will tell you, the folks in opposition will tell you, that there's an assurance of voluntary compliance, a multi-state assurance of voluntary compliance, but I called the Attorney General's office into my office after I got that information, and I said, tell me about that AVC, the Assurance of Voluntary Compliance. Well, it only goes after the big three wireless companies, and if you look, that only covers Singular / AT&T. I'm never sure what they are now, even though that's my service provider, Sprint, Nextel, and Verizon. And on this sheet that opposes 2621, they say this: the wireless industry is fully competitive with 9 companies competing in Oregon. Well, Mr. Chair, only 3 of them are covered under the assurance of voluntary compliance. So what happens to the other 6? The opponents of this bill will tell you that because it's a competitive industry, then the customers will get served well because they're going to pay attention to those customers, because otherwise the customer will just go to another carrier. Well, they can't really necessarily go to another carrier. Have you ever signed one of those contracts? It's usually for a year, and if you cut out early, you got to pay a penalty. And the phones are awfully expensive, so I would submit that it's not that easy for a customer to go to another carrier. So I like what you've done over here on this bill. Congress has said that the states can regulate consumer complaints, but of course the opponents will tell you Congress has not said that, but that has been left up to us. So I believe what we're doing here is appropriate. Deregulating Quest and the other carriers is appropriate in terms of what's been going on in our state with telecommunications. And I would urge a strong support for this bill. I had to, when some of the many lobbyists came to see me, I had to chuckle a little bit because they said, we just get virtually no complaints, even though it's among the top 10 complaints from the Oregon Attorney General's office, because I have 4 members in my family and 2 of us have had serious complaints about our cell service providers. So that's 50% right there. So I'm already batting a pretty good average. So, Mr. Chair, with that, I'll turn it over to either esteemed colleague on my right or my left.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think the gentlemanly thing to do is for ladies to go first, so I would defer to Representative.
The chair appreciates your advanced chivalry, and
especially if he wants this bill heard on the House side, right?
And Representative Rosenbaum, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Diane Rosenbaum from House District 42. And I am appearing today also in support of House Bill 2621. I served in the interim on a telecommunications task force, as did Representative Tom Butler, from whom you'll be hearing shortly. And in our committee, we tried very hard to come up with a consensus bill, which turned out to be virtually impossible. But I'd say the bill that is before you today, if there were to be one, is just about as close as we could have come, but we didn't get there. Those who know me will know that I am not a big fan of deregulation generally, and this is not something that I would lightly support. But I do think that the bill before you today is a compromise. It does preserve some essential phone service regulation that consumer protection advocates that were on our task force insisted on having in the bill. And the only reason, really, that I'm supporting it is because it also includes beefed up consumer protection authority for the Public Utility Commission. I think that the good senator from Eugene spoke very ably about the problem with wireless carriers, and I'm sure you'll be hearing a lot from them today, and I'm sure you already have from what I read in the paper. But I think that, you know, the arguments that are being made that there's no problem just don't hold up to scrutiny, in my view. You know, the fact that people are signing contracts that are pretty ironclad contracts really does undercut the argument that there's all this competition in this industry and therefore people will just vote with their feet. You know, it would be easy to vote with your feet if you didn't have to pay $175 every time you wanted to make a change, but that is a pretty hefty penalty for people to pay. I think that, you know, there already is evidence from the complaints that the Public Utility Commission gets that people are having problems with service quality or their billing or various aspects of their service. I mean, we've even read in the newspaper stories of people continuing to be billed for their service after they were dead and having problems getting out from under their contracts in those cases. So, Mr. Chair, I see you looking at the clock, and I think that would probably be a good indication that I've spoken long enough. So I just want to say I think the bill is a compromise, and that it's one that I support enthusiastically.
And thank you. Me looking at the clock shouldn't have sped you up at all. I appreciate your observance.
And, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions, but I am in another committee, and so...
Thank you for that, and I'll probably, unless I would dispense with any questions for you now. We have a really long list of testimony to get through, and my intent is really to hear the testimony today, and we're not moving this bill today, and we'll have yet another opportunity for questions.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you. Senator,
sorry
to keep you waiting, but I think it was a good move on your part.
Absolutely.
And mine. And Representative Butler, you're welcome to join us.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair, colleagues. For the record, Frank Morse, State Senator, District 8, Albany and Corvallis. This is very unfamiliar territory for me as a businessman to come in and request that you consider what might be perceived as an additional layer of regulation. But what I see in this industry, it's very strange. When you see the advertisements, fewest dropped calls would suggest in and of itself that there's a service level issue for consumers. When you have an industry that requires long-term contracts, now there may be ways of getting out of them, but are they fair to the consumer when you find something that isn't working right? The language in this bill would not be necessary if you essentially prohibited the long-term contracts. If people find the service is lousy, they can go to another provider and get the same other lousy service and migrate from one carrier to the next. I appreciate the perspective of the industry on this issue, but there's also something that I think has not risen to the level of consciousness that it should in this assembly, and that is the issue of public safety. We have more and more people that are depending with greater and greater dependence upon wireless. And public safety is something that I think we should be conscious of, particularly when we look at the request for bonding authority for Olin. This is a huge issue to confront. How does cellular play into that public safety discussion? And I think it will in the future. It's an exploding industry in technology. And I think wireless will play a big measure in emergency preparedness and interoperability in the future. So I lend my support to this role that PUC can play to facilitate complaints with consumers and the providers, and lend support to this bill. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Senator. Representative, a few words.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Tom Butler from House District 60 in southeastern Oregon. And originally, House Bill 2621 was conceived to be what I called dereg light. Basically, it was most states are moving to some kind of deregulation of one kind or another with regard to the wire industry. And so based upon, as Representative Rosenbaum has indicated to you, based upon the interim hearings which we had relative to the telecommunications industry, and trying to seek some kind of a compromise amongst the group as to how to deregulate the wireline industry, which is a dying industry. It's an industry whose future is very dim, and on the other hand, the wireless industry, the future of the technology is very bright. That said, I would like to just spin off of what Senator Morris has indicated. When you're talking about exploding technology, then you know why we lose access to the lines. The technology is moving very rapidly, and unfortunately, we're expecting more out of the cell industry than perhaps what they're capable of delivering at this particular point. And I do support dereg light, some method of bringing a deregulation to the process of the wireline industry. The wireline industry is eventually going to work themselves out of a job. That's all there is to it. There will be wires perhaps within certain structures and buildings and those kinds of things, but the rest of the wireline industry in the future will be a thing of the past. And consequently, I do want to encourage the committee to consider 2621 with the dash one amendment, which basically is the bill. But I also would like to encourage the industries to still work together to see if we can't bring the regulation. I don't want to over-regulate in this process an industry which is still rolling out. And if we can encourage that industry, Oregon would be a unique state in over-regulating if we went too far. And so if we can encourage that industry, the wireless industry, to roll itself out in a proper fashion as we deregulate the going away, the dying industry of the cell or of the wireline industry, then I think we can get a good blend. So I would encourage the committee to look at the possibility of making sure that the two sides of the industry are still working together so that we can force a compromise. And again, we can have dereg light in this process. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. It's always nice to have that scenario where the industry brings a compromise to us instead of sticking us in the middle of two sides opposed and us trying to come up with a compromise. I appreciate your comments and appreciate this is a record of having senators from both sides of the aisle, representatives of both sides of the aisle, four of them testifying on this bill in front of our committee. It's really a privilege to have all of you testify. Before you get away, Representative Nelson, you have a quick question?
I have a very quick question. I certainly don't want him to get away, especially not the representative who's been looking at the back of my head for 2 years. Now I get to see him face forward.
Now, take your shot.
And thank you all for being here. My biggest concern with this bill is that we know it's going to increase costs on the consumer, and we just spent weeks and weeks and weeks coming up with a 36% cap on payday and title loans, and now we're... three bills later, we're doing something to increase the burden on the consumer. So I just, do you not agree with me? And if not, Senator Morris, could you tell me what's the matter with my head?
Thank you.
No, that's impossible, I'm sure.
Representative Nelson, I guess I don't see the increased cost to consumers. If the industry is providing a quality product, you won't have the complaints. And if there is service and customers are satisfied, I don't see where the PUC role in this in facilitating those complaints with the companies to help resolve them will increase costs. I just don't see it that way.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I concur fully. The fact that deregulation would indicate that prices are going to go up is evidence that is not a reality. That's evidence of what's happened in the airlines. It's what's happened in the transportation industry in general. If the less regulation you have on an industry of this nature, typically the more you're going to drive down prices because they'll be able to compete and lower their prices accordingly, and then competition truly takes over.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, I almost called you Senator Nelson.
That's okay.
There should not be an increase in cost here, particularly with the deregulation, because eventually they're going to creep up a little bit. But that's part of the bill, is to make sure that your basic phone service stays at a regulated sort of a regulated rate in a deregulated market. And if the wireless providers are telling you costs are going to go up to the consumer, well, that's hooey, because all we're doing is asking complaints to be funneled to the PUC and the PUC having that authority. And I quite frankly, if there are no complaints, as Senator Moore says, then there's nothing they have to worry about.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, this is a long glide slope, and that's why we call it dereg light. was it gives a long, long time for it to fully phase in, gives the PUC oversight, gives the phone companies an opportunity to continue to work mutually together, including the cell industry, cellular industry, and I think that it gives an opportunity for them all to work together towards a proper transition and a phasing from the wireline industry to the cellular industry.
Thank you for your answers.
Thank you so much for gracing us with your presence today. I appreciate your testimony.
That was unusual. I've never seen that. All my years, I've never seen it.
Commissioner Beyer, I don't know if you wish to testify now. I do have several people from out of the area I want to get in, but if you wish to make a brief statement, that would be fine, or if you wish to wait and make it later, that'd be fine too. Thank you for that consideration. So with that, I'd like to start off with, let's see. Looking for people from more than 100 miles away, I have a panel. Jerry Keegan, Dan Yeomans, Russell Sarazen, and Michael Bagley. And gentlemen, in the interest of time, I'm hoping you can keep your comments really short, to the point, within a couple of minutes,
okay,
if that's possible, and state your name for the record. And if you have written testimony, be sure to turn it into the committee assistant, too, as well.
Sure.
Thank you.
Chairman Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Keegan. I am Director of State Legislative Affairs with CTIA, the Wireless Association. CTIA represents the wireless telecommunications industry, carriers, manufacturers, and Internet content providers. The wireless industry does take customer service seriously. Since 2003, CTIA's Consumer Code for Wireless Service has been an integral part of delivering superior service to wireless consumers. The code, which is followed in all 50 states, has helped consumers make informed decisions when selecting a wireless plan and has contributed to the continued competitiveness of the wireless industry. Carriers who are signatories to the code disclose to consumers the rates and terms of service. They disclose service maps, as well as provide at least a 14-day trial period and ready access to customer service. Moreover, signatories pledge to promptly respond to consumer inquiries and complaints received from federal and state agencies within 30 days of receiving written notification. In addition to CTIA's consumer code, major wireless carriers and attorneys general in 33 states, including Oregon, have signed an agreement of voluntary compliance, or an AVC, which requires carriers to comply with similar business practices as those outlined in CTIA's code. Wireless is a competitive industry. That competition was spurred by Congress's decision in 1993 to create a national wireless framework. That framework has brought affordable wireless services to over 230 million Americans. That, from the complaints from those 230 million Americans, according to recent FCC data, has declined by 40% from June 2005 to June 2006. Dan will touch upon the complaint rate from Oregon, but nationally that represents 19 complaints per 1 million subscriber. In comparison to the regulation that's being proposed in House Bill 2621, the regulation of the wireless industry proposed in HB 2621 is contrary to the national trend, which is to deregulate the industry. 31 states plus the District of Columbia currently do not regulate the industry. In addition to those states, a handful of others have agreements with wireless carriers to refrain from regulating the industry as long as the wireless marketplace remains competitive, which it does. States that do regulate wireless are working with the industry to educate consumers about wireless services as opposed to adopting inflexible rules regarding service. In California, for example, the state PUC has pursued consumer education through a cooperative, non-regulatory approach with the industry. This initiative, CalPhoneInfo.com, provides consumers with helpful information about cell phone service, cell phone contracts, billing practices, and phone contracts. In closing, the state attorney general currently has the power to protect wireless consumers and the authority to enforce the AVC, as well as consumer protection laws of general applicability. Why is there a need for additional regulation? I ask the committee to oppose House Bill 2620 as amended.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Chairman Holby and members of the committee, my name is Dan Yeomans. I'm here today representing Singular Wireless and AT&T. Singular and AT&T do oppose House Bill 2621. In our view, it really does not make sense to deregulate the wireline side of the industry at the expense of regulating a fully competitive industry like wireless, and I would also add into that emerging technologies like voice over IP, because that is also a very important component of this legislation. We feel that these regulations are not necessary and do have the potential to divert much-needed resources that could be better spent on improving network coverage, lowering prices, and providing even better service to our customers. We have a very good working relationship right now with the PUC here in Oregon. We work with them on a daily basis sometimes to resolve complaints for our customers. And if you take a look at our numbers over the last 2 years, it's very similar to the chart that's being handed out right now. Complaints are coming down. And I think a big part of this is because we're complying with the AVC that has been established here. We're complying with the code. Our networks are getting better and better, and because of the overall competitive industry that we are in. If you take a look at this chart, and I really want to go right at this issue of complaints because it seems to be central to this issue. If you take a look at this chart, it shows two things. First of all, actual numbers of complaints are declining. And number two, which I think is even more significant, is the actual number of complaints in comparison to the total subscriber base ends up being about 0.03%. So it's a very small number of people that are complaining to the commission about their service. And in fact, the 653 number represents all contacts with the commission. Some of those are just informational contacts that they're making, are not an actual problem with their service. So I really think that's what's key here. I think the other issue is, if we're already working with the commission, then what's the need for this legislation? Well, the really key part of this legislation is it creates a whole new investigative and hearing process and possibly administrative ruling process that we are going to have to go through. We do not feel that's necessary, and the resources that we are spending there could be much better spent expanding our networks and serving our customers. There are a number of other provisions in this bill, including creating things like an educational program for wireless customers. We are more than happy to work with the commission on a voluntary basis to create such a program. We've done that in California. We've done that in the state of Washington. In fact, in the state of Washington, we even helped pay for that program, and we'd be more than happy to do that here, but we really do not feel that needs to be created in legislation. Finally, I want to wrap up again by addressing the voice over IP question. I have to kind of put my AT&T hat on for that, because that's a service that aspect of our business provides. We really think the state of Oregon would be going down a dangerous path at this point, trying to regulate these emerging technologies that rely on the Internet. Other states have attempted this, including Minnesota, and have lost in court when they've been challenged. And so I would just urge this committee to take a very careful look at that particular issue and the types of legal problems that you may have if that's the direction that you go. With that, I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. And again, state your name for the record and try to keep it brief if we can. I appreciate it. Get some more testimony in.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Michael Begley. I'm the Executive Director for Public Policy for the West.
Mr. Begley, can you push that mic back away from me? They're very sensitive. You don't really need to talk into them too close.
I apologize, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
That's great.
On behalf of Verizon Wireless, I'd like to express my appreciation for the opportunity to be here today. Verizon Wireless is a major national wireless carrier with over 56 million customers nationwide, over 700,000 in the great state of Oregon. We put tremendous resources in the state each year to ensure that our customers continue to get the best in services and equipment, cell coverage, and customer care. We're very proud of our reputation for reliability and customer satisfaction. So we invest in our customers because that's the right thing to do, but we also recognize that wireless customers have choices. If they don't want to be with us, they have choices in the marketplace. Over the past 10 years, the twin engines of competition and deregulation have not only kept the wireless industry viable, but has been a boon to consumers. So just want to briefly mention in the past decade, minutes of use, cost per minute have gone down by 74%, from 44 cents a minute to less than 11 cents a minute. But while prices were going down, the average minutes of use increased by 200%. As wireless has become more and more affordable, with better and more diverse services, the number of wireless customers have greatly increased in the nation, from 16 million in 1993 to over 180 million today. But the consumer has been the winner. We oppose HB 2621 because it threatens to impose unnecessary regulation on the competitive wireless industry. It's very odd to us that in the same bill that purports to offer flexibility in one segment of the telecom market, they will at the same time seek to shackle the most competitive segment in the industry. But of course, with the growth of the industry and with the number of customers, there are occasionally complaints, and sometimes the complaints are only inquiries. So we also have to look at the nature of those complaints. But as Dan stated, and as Jared did, the wireless industry is more than happy to work with the Oregon Public Utilities Commission, who work with the Attorney General and any others. I know I myself met with the Oregon PUC 3 years ago, gave them the name who contacted their complaints, and we would certainly want to work with to resolve that. We believe the Oregon PUC, based on the data, receives very few complaints, and I'll just speak for Verizon Wireless. From our experience, out of over 700,000 customers in the state, in 2006, the Oregon Commission received 74 complaints about Verizon Wireless. 74 complaints to the Commission out of over 70,000 customers. It would seem to us pretty heavy-handed to do regulation through legislation with very command and control procedures in place for 74 complaints when we just sit down with the Commission and work those issues out. We want to address our customers' concerns. But we think that would be a little bit too much. And I do also want to point out that, you know, even the states that border Oregon, Washington State, Idaho, Nevada, California, they don't regulate wireless. In fact, California passed some consumer rules and then rescinded them because they realized that this was going to be very costly to the consumer. The irony here is the consumer pay. Now, we're not going to make a one-to-one correlation. Now, I certainly wouldn't say that any cost will be passed on. What I can do tell you, though, is we have limited resources. We want to put those resources where consumers care about the most. We want to put those in the sales sites. Okay, we put over $300 million into Oregon in the last 5 years. We put over $100 million last year. We're going to put those resources into sales sites, more store employees, stores, customer care. We have to train our people. We can take those resources away and put them into all of these inquiries and hearings and all these other regulatory procedures, but that's not what customers want. If you're complaining about cell coverage, the only way to fix that is to put up cell towers. Cell towers are costly, so we want to put the money where it needs to go. But to the extent customers come to the commission and they have concerns, we're absolutely willing to sit down with the commission. And the ABC, the assurance of all their compliance, which is an agreement that three major carriers entered into it with the Attorney General, is not the only means by which we have committed to the customers. We also have a national consumer code. We have our own practices and procedures. For us, for example, we have got J.D. Power Awards. We've had consumer reports talk about our service. We are a scrutinized industry. There are lots of watchdogs out there looking at what we do. But give us a chance to work with the commission, and we can do that without having regulation. And I just want to say one last thing about contracts. I know it was stated that, you know, we lock folks in the contracts. I would just say, speaking only for Verizon Wireless, we do not lock you in the contracts. The reason we have contracts in the first place, we don't make these handsets. These handsets are made by other manufacturers. We ensure a big cost. When you sign up with a contract, what we're doing is we're amortizing the cost of this handset to the consumer over the life of the contract. Because we, for example, give a 30-day early termination period. Once you leave us, even if you use it for 30 days, we cannot use this again. We could get rid of contracts and have the consumer pay $600, $700 for a phone up front. Doesn't seem fair to folks. So part of the contract is that you amortize it out. Now, what we would do, let's say, for example, you and your wife have a job in...
And Mr. Banger, could you wrap it up?
Yes, sir.
I really would like to...
I apologize. One last second on this. I'm going to say, let's say a couple lives in a certain location in Oregon. One of them gets a job in Washington State. They move. They're 6 months into their contract. We recognize that that's when, right? If they move somewhere in Washington and they don't have service, we let them out of contract. We let folks out of contracts all the time. But I just want to say we're flexible because we want to work with customers. I appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Russell Sarahs in T-Mobile USA. I will be extremely brief, taking off the point that Michael was talking about in terms of investment. T-Mobile has over 1,800 employees in the state of Oregon. We have facilities in Salem, Redmond, Portland, and elsewhere. Those types of investments would also be things that we would look at as a company. Where are we going to put our resources? In addition, you talk about the handsets. You can walk into a store and buy a prepaid phone. You can go to other providers like Cricket. There are many other ways to purchase these devices without a contract. There are certain advantages to having a contract, but again, it is a trade-off for the consumer. It's a decision that they can make as to how they're going to consume this service. Last, on the public safety piece that was brought up earlier, I would just ask, you know, all of us that have these phones now, we have this opportunity to contact public safety when we didn't in the past. If you look at the innovations over the past 20 years in this industry in terms of contacting public safety when we never could have in the past, walking down the street, being on a highway, being out in rural areas, you look at the high-speed data services, email, internet connectivity. This is not the kind of device that is equal to the phone that you plug into the wall. It's a much different, much more complex type of the service that we're providing. And by trying to compare apples and oranges in terms of regulatory oversight, we think is just going down the wrong path, and again would oppose the bill like my colleagues here on this panel. Thank you very much for the time to testify.
Thank you very much, and I'm sure you gentlemen could provide us testimony for a couple hours on this subject matter, but I appreciate your brevity, and I think you made your point well. I really appreciate your coming out here and giving us your testimony. Next up, I'd like to have David Valdez, Amy Tykeson, and Art Butler. Trace?
Can I come up here with David Valdez? It's Verizon. Meaning it's Verizon now.
Sure, I guess so. Boy, I called up too many people, huh? Three made five. Okay, go ahead.
Alphabetical order?
Oh, I'm going first.
But please, gentlemen, do try to keep it brief. I've only got about 15 minutes left, and so if you guys stick to 2 minutes, I really would appreciate it.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Art Butler. I'm with the Ader Wynn Law Firm. I'm here representing Tracer, which is a coalition that represents the interests of large telecommunications users. Large users, sometimes called enterprise customers, have a vital interest in ensuring that critical telecommunications services remain available at fair, just, and reasonable rates, and ensuring that the state of Oregon obtains and maintains an efficient, effectively competitive marketplace. Tracer opposes House Bill 2621 for two primary reasons. First, it would deregulate the provision of important services, notwithstanding the fact that current competition is not sufficient to constrain the pricing of incumbent local exchange companies to keep their prices to the competitive level. Secondly, the bill would remove important protections against predatory pricing and could harm what existing wireline competition there is in this state. The basis of the bill is a finding, legislative finding, that there is effective competition. That finding is inconsistent with Tracer's experience in the marketplace, with an expert analysis that we commissioned for Oregon Public Utility Commission docket called UX29, which was a comprehensive examination of the existence of competition throughout Quest service territory for switched business services. In that case, the commission found that outside of Clackamas and Portland rate centers, effective competition did not exist for any business services in the state. Within Portland and Clackamas, effective competition existed only for basic business lines for customers that took four or more lines. That competition was not sufficient to constrain pricing for customers that had fewer than four lines, or for the PBX, ISDN, or Centrex type services that medium and large customers buy. The finding in the bill is also inconsistent with the Commission's latest report on the state of competition that's submitted to the legislature, which finds that competition varies widely throughout the state of Oregon, and that the competitive carriers, wireline carriers, serve only 16% of the wirelines in this state. The FCC, in its most recent report on the state of local competition, also found that competitive carriers serve 16% of the market, and that's down from 19% that they reported 6 months before. I will just make two more brief points. First is that we think that there is adequate flexibility in current law for incumbent carriers to respond to competition. I detailed that flexibility in my testimony. And also I would like to note that the commission in its report to the legislature stated that there were no laws that needed to be amended, repealed, or changed in order to permit effective incumbent carriers to respond to effective competition. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next up.
Chairman, good afternoon. Committee, thank you very much for this opportunity to address this very important issue. I will not reiterate my testimony that I have filed with you, but I would like to leave you with a few thoughts. I am the Senior Vice President for Verizon, the Greater Northwest Region. Jing Ng is our Vice President here in Oregon, and he will be speaking in detail of the provisions of...
And your name was?
David Valdez. I apologize, sir.
Thank you.
And I guess I'd like to kind of just share the good news. And the good news is that Verizon is investing very heavily in the state of Oregon. Recently, it was announced that we have, by the end of 2007, we'll have passed 200,000 homes with fiber optic technology. By the end of 2007, Verizon will have spent $170 million in this new technology, and we have also begun the construction of a multi-million dollar complex in the city of Beaverton that is going to provide jobs and additional opportunities for Verizon consumers. We're very excited about this partnership because Oregon is only one of 18 states that's getting this investment. This investment is the future. Me and my colleagues have to go to the parent company and make our pitch for why we should make the investment in Oregon, and my counterparts in the various other states go to the same place for capital dollars, and at the end of the day, the company decides where it's going to invest, and Oregon is one of the states where this investment is being made. As a consequence, we're very, very concerned of the policy decisions that are being made in Oregon because they have serious consequences for the consumers that we serve. In closing, I'd like to just leave you with the thought that what Verizon is doing is building out a fiber network that no other company in the state is doing. This particular legislation would be setting us back and would be setting the wrong message. The regulation of new and innovative services should be encouraged and not discouraged. In fact, my colleague from Verizon Wireless, who spoke earlier, really was speaking about an American dream story. And the wireless industry is a success story that should be touted throughout not only the United States but the world for what happens for this startup industry that mushroomed in a relatively short period of time, and it did so without the benefit of regulation. And then the final point that I will leave you with, in my previous life I was a senior policy advisor in the Clinton administration, and one of my tasks was to look at the rise of the internet, and there was a lot of concern in the early 90s that the internet was somehow going to change the world and you had to regulate it. Well, there was a decision made that we should leave the internet alone and not touch it, and as a result we see where the internet is today. So when you look at the VoIP, when you look at VoIP legislation and trying to regulate this emerging technology, you will hear a tale of terrible things that are going to happen. But if you look at the two instances where there's been no regulation, internet, wireless, it is the success story of the U.S. economy in terms of it being able to grow at phenomenal rates and has been an example for other countries around the world. So with that, I'd like to close.
Thank you. And I would like to ask you, since you're in the building, if you would mind coming back and giving us your testimony at a later time.
Okay.
You didn't mark down that you were more than 100 miles away, and I've got some other folks that are, and I only have 10 minutes left. So I appreciate that consideration.
Sure. Chairman Hovey, that's fine with me.
Thank you. As long as you don't say anything.
There you go. Mr. Chair, for the record, Mike Dewey, representing a dying industry, the Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association. I have to talk with the Honorable Butler. I've done this for the association since 1976. I'd like to introduce from Bend Broadband, Amy Tykeson, who's the president of the Cable Association and president and CEO of Bend Broadband, and I will be quiet.
Thank you.
And she will talk. You're welcome.
Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee, for allowing me to speak with you today. Bend Broadband is an independent cable company, and we serve Central Oregon, three systems over in Central Oregon. And over the past 4 years, we've invested over $32 million in private risk capital to advance our services over there. We face robust competition in our product lines. We provide video service, internet service, and also digital voice service. And we compete with DBS, DirecTV, and the Dish Network, as well as Quest, Clearwire, and others. As background and for perspective, in the video realm, you may know that cable used to be regulated by local authorities because there was limited competition. Congress facilitated competition and helped our industry move towards deregulation of cable in three ways. First, they granted spectrum to the DBS provider so they could send and receive their satellite signals. Second, they did not regulate new entrants. And third, they kept cable regulated until new entrants became viable and gained significant market share. The government set a threshold for new entrants to achieve, and once that threshold was passed, cable was deregulated. The same process should apply for voice services. Over the past year and a half, Bend Broadband has attracted just 8% of residents in our footprint to our digital voice product. Importantly, fewer than 1% of businesses in Central Oregon take our business service, our digital voice business service. We're just getting off the ground. So if we have 1%, 99% of the digital voice services provided to businesses in Bend, Oregon are served by Quest, either directly or indirectly through reseller agreements with CLEX, like the person was just speaking about before me. For business services, really, there is not a lot of options. A business is not going to take a cellular solution, and they probably aren't going to take Vonage either, because they need different features to help them serve multiple lines in their businesses and so forth. So I would like to ask you, you know, what would happen in Bend if Quest was deregulated? And I would envision two dynamics would occur. First, there would be an increase in wholesale prices to the CLEX. And second, there would be a reduction in their prices to consumers and businesses. Well, one might think, wouldn't price decreases be a good thing? Well, not if the net effect would potentially drive smaller CLEX and competitors like us just beginning to gain market share in the voice services businesses into an unprofitable position. In essence, Quest would choke off long-term meaningful competition. What is the role of regulation in the absence of meaningful competition? It is to protect consumers, and I would suggest protect nascent or emerging competitors in their early stages to provide long-term choice and cost benefit to consumers. What is cable voice over internet protocol? Really, it's sending the telephone call in a different way. It's going over our cable infrastructure to what we would call a private broadband provider to the other end, whoever that is. That person could have voice over internet, or they could be a Quest or a customer of an ILEC getting through the PSTN, which is the public switch network. So that's how it is a little bit different.
If you could give us a summary now and kind of wrap it up, I'd like to get
I'm happy
more
to.
Testimony.
In addition to the example of lack of meaningful competition in Central Oregon, there were two studies, one that came out as recently as January of this year and one in September of 2006 that the PUC was part of. And in both of those studies, it was found that there was not adequate competition to allow deregulation. House Bill 2621 proposes to deregulate Quest and the ILECs in spite of findings of these studies. If the goal is to facilitate competition and provide better pricing and options for consumers and businesses in Oregon in the long term, premature deregulation and cost-impacting oversight will only hinder progress toward that end. In closing, Bend Broadband and the OCTA members ask that House Bill 2621 remain in committee. Thank you.
And we still have a lot of respect for the PUC, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for traveling here and giving us your testimony. We have your written testimony as well. I really appreciate your input.
Thank you.
And sorry about the brevity. I'd like to call up Nancy Judy and Barb Young. I assume it's Nancy Judy, yes, is your full name. It's not two people.
I thought it was like Nancy Young, Judy Young, Barb Young.
I did too.
All right. Sorry.
The bill's complicated enough.
I got a lot of work to do with this committee. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Chairman Holvey and committee members. I'm Nancy Judy. I'm the state executive for Embark Corporation, which is formerly the local division of Sprint. We're the fourth largest telecommunication provider in the state, and we are hoping that you will support House Bill 2621. Even in rural Oregon, we're facing increasing competition and are really hindered in our ability to compete by the existing laws. This bill will provide greater consumer choices by giving wireline regulated companies the chance to compete. We can put together what are traditionally regulated services and non-regulated services without running into the administrative obstacles that we run into today. The bill also balances pricing flexibility with consumer protection measures. This is by no means complete deregulation. We still must abide by the service quality standards, and it puts caps on basic local prices. It also maintains the current toll-free calling areas. And further, it allows the Commission to re-regulate any service if the Commission finds that there is insufficient competition. We urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you very much for traveling and being patient, and I'm glad I got at least through the testimony of people who are more than 100 miles away. I appreciate those that testified, and I apologize if I seem like I rushed you. But it's just sort of the nature of the day, I guess. And I apologize to the PUC for not having time to hear your testimony today.
He's pretty local.
Okay, I'd like to go ahead and carry this bill over to Friday. And here's some more testimony for those that are signed up. If you're able to come back, great. If you're not, I apologize. If you have written testimony that you would like to turn in, please do so. And we'll have a little more time on Friday to revisit this issue. So I appreciate everybody with that. I'd like to close the public hearing on House Bill 2621.
That would have been very good. That would have been good.
With that.